Hello, welcome to Playback Daily with me, Trevor Keegan. We know you can't usually hear all the highlights from RTE Radio 1 on a given day, so we do extra listening for you. This time round, it's the best bits from Tuesday, the 25th of February. Coming up.
My inspiration from Bone Man was when we were learning about the human body in class. The teacher told us to draw a bone and I got a bit distracted and I ended up making it into a superhero.
You'll see them coming out of the hive and they just fly around, do their business, and you'll notice it on leaves. And this is honeybees as well, but obviously other bees will do it. But if you do notice specks on your windscreen or your washing line and you're like, what is that? It's probably bee poop.
Bee has had a colonic.
The chemicals that we secrete in the body when we're anxious are the same chemicals that we secrete when we're excited. When we're fearful and when we're anxious, we've got the exact same mechanism going on in the body.
Playback Daily on RTE Radio 1.
There was a bit of political posturing going on in Washington as French President Macron paid a visit to President Trump with what looked like a game of you said, I said. It might be funny if the main topic wasn't so serious, namely Ukraine. On Morning Ireland, Audrey Carvel led an interview about their meeting with some of the questions that should have been uppermost in the president's minds.
Can the war in Ukraine, inflicted by Russia, be brought to an end in a matter of weeks? Will European leaders be involved in talks on a final peace agreement? Will Ukraine? Will peacekeeping troops from NATO countries have boots on the ground in Ukraine once an agreement is reached? Will the Russian president accept that? Is NATO membership for Ukraine definitively off the table? So many questions, and they remain largely unanswered following the first meeting between US President Donald Trump and a major European leader, Emmanuel Macron of France, at the White House. The two men appeared very friendly towards each other. The body language, the manly handshakes, the French leader praising, flattering, cajoling the American one, referring to him at least twice as Dear Donald. All this after weeks of the harshest of language being used against Europe by many in the Trump administration, including its vice president, directly to their faces at the Munich Security Conference recently. Language which directly implied that the US could no longer be counted on to come to Europe's defence in a time of war. Presidents Trump and Macron sat knee to knee in the Oval Office on one occasion last night while talking to reporters. The only real point of conflict emerged when President Trump spoke about how much money the United States had given to Ukraine compared to Europe.
Europe is loaning the money to Ukraine. They get their money back.
No, in fact, to be frank, we paid. We paid 60% of the total effort. And it was through, like the US, loans, guarantee, grants, and we provided real money, to be clear. Yeah. We have 230 billion frozen assets in Europe, Russian assets, but this is not as a collateral of a loan because this is not our belonging. So they are frozen. If at the end of the day in the negotiation we will have with Russia, they're ready to give it to us, super. It will be loan at the end of the day and Russia will have paid for that.
If you
this
believe that, it's okay with me.
Mr. President,
they get their money back and we don't, and now we do.
Both President Trump and President Macron said the war in Ukraine could be over within weeks. The US leader said he would meet the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky soon and that he would also meet the Russian leader, with a suggestion that he might even travel to Moscow. President Zelensky wants security guarantees from the United States and Europe. He wants to know that if and when the war ends, that Russia will not invade again at some point in the future. That is why he wants NATO membership for his country. It's why he also wants outside peacekeepers. This dominated President Macron's comments at a news conference in the White House last night. Heard here through an interpreter, he said he and President Trump had reached a turning point on this issue.
We were able to talk about the details of the security guarantees, and the president has shown this over the past few days, and he said so a moment ago, we want peace. He wants peace. We want peace swiftly, but we don't want an agreement that is weak. The fact that there are Europeans that are ready to engage to provide for these security guarantees, and now there's a clear American message that the U.S., as an ally, is ready to provide that solidarity for that approach. That's a turning point, in my view.
While reporters asked President Trump if he had raised the prospect of peacekeepers from NATO countries being on Ukrainian soil with the Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, he will accept that. I've asked him that question.
You talked to him?
I've asked him that question.
Is Prince going to lift the block on the...
Because he's not... Look, if we do this deal, he's not looking for more war. He doesn't mind. But I've specifically asked him that question. He has no problem with it.
Well, let's discuss this now with Vitaly Shevchenko, Russia editor at BBC Monitoring and co-presenter of the BBC's Ukraine Cast podcast. Vitaly, you're very welcome indeed to Morning Ireland. Could you just pick up on that last point there that Trump says Putin told him he has no problem with EU peacekeepers in Ukraine, yet the Russian foreign minister last week in Riyadh said they could not support such a move?
Well, all these statements that have been coming out of Washington and Russia, and also what President Zelensky of Ukraine has been saying, they paint a rather confusing picture. The what it boils down to, really, is that Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin are really determined to deal with this with each other and sort this problem out by talking to each other. And that's the reason why Emmanuel Macron is or was in Washington yesterday. That's why Keir Starmer of the UK is traveling to the US on Thursday, because they're feeling sidelined. And frankly, I believe it when it happens, if or when America and Russia sign any agreements. That's when I believe it, because what they've been saying is rather conflicting. First, we heard from America's defense secretary that Ukraine will not be able to reclaim any territory captured by Russia, that Ukraine should forget about joining NATO. Then various American officials seem to row back from those statements and are now seeming to say that nothing is off the table. When it comes to this whole idea of peacekeepers, again, it's not clear who they can be, what they will be able to do, because, as you say, Russia said that, well, it will not accept the deployment of troops from any NATO country to Ukraine, even if they're deployed by these individual countries, not NATO as an alliance. And also, importantly, when Emmanuel Macron was speaking about what these troops might potentially be doing in Ukraine, he said they shouldn't go to the front line or go into confrontation. That's a quote. And I'm sure in Volodymyr Zelensky's mind, this is raising the question, okay, so if they're not going to be there to fight, what will they be doing there?
What is the point?
We hear a lot about anxiety, but how do you know the difference between everyday concerns and actual anxiety that may need more concentrated care? Oliver Callan had an expert author and guest who has written extensively about that topic.
Owen O'Kane is a practicing psychotherapist, former palliative care specialist and a Sunday Times best-selling author. He's a new book out. It's called Addicted to Anxiety, and it's inspired in lots of ways by his own experience. He grew up in Belfast during the Troubles. He had a terrible time in school as well. But he broke the habit of his anxiety, and he believes in his expertise. We have habits around anxiety. He has the advice that will help break them. And he joins us from the BBC studios in London. Good morning, Owen O'Kane.
Morning, Oliver. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. How are you today from an anxiety point of view?
I'm good. I'm really good, actually. Busy, but I'm good. I was actually, I'm laughing, actually. The kids were great beforehand. they should be writing books.
They are, thankfully. Yeah, but you're dead right. You already sound like a calming force yourself. But you believe we're living in an anxiety epidemic, pandemic affecting, is it every age, everybody?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it was sort of part of the motivation for writing Addicted to Anxiety. I guess I'm seeing more anxiety than I've ever done in my career, to be honest.
Right.
And it's right across the spectrum, you know, from, you know, I hear parents talking about their kids, to young teenagers, adults, and interestingly with older people as well. So I do think we are generation anxious at the moment. So when I thought about what my next book would be, I thought, all right, I want it to be an anxiety, but I didn't want it to be a kind of fluffy false promise of heal your anxiety in a day or anything like that. I wanted it to be real, and I wanted it to be, I guess, empowering in some ways, because one of the difficult conversations about anxiety is that people often contribute more to their own anxiety than they realise, and right. we rarely have that conversation. So I guess I see people almost get hooked on the process of anxiety, which motivated the title Addicted to Anxiety.
Oh, it's a fascinating idea, but the whole thing is very personal to you, isn't it? Anxiety, you were hardwired yeah. into you from the troubles growing up where you grew up?
Yeah, I think when you do books and you use these platforms and stuff, I think you have to be brave enough to talk about your own story.
Yeah.
And I didn't realise actually that I was anxious until I left for London. You know, I grew up in Belfast during the Troubles, as you mentioned, and during that period, you were primarily hardwired for anxiety. Most people were growing up during that period. And that actually was a good thing. Anxiety can be a really healthy mechanism. And during that period, to not be anxious would have been problematic because you needed to be on watch and you needed to be on guard. But I guess the problem with it is then when you leave and you've carried the anxiety with you and you realise that you're in this kind of almost hypervigilant state a lot of the time when you don't need to be, that's when you realise it's problematic. So, I mean, unapologetically, I often talk about that and I use it in my work because I think, at the end of the day, Oliver, we're all human beings. Mm-hmm. And these conversations are about our humanity rather than a diagnosis.
At home for you was the Ardoyne in Belfast. So that was, unfortunately, a busy place from a news point of view during the Troubles.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it certainly, I mean, look, it was no playground, let's put it like that, I guess. Yeah. Just even the position of it was right in the heart of a lot of the conflict. So I guess for me and for everyone during that period, I mean, it was just normal to be in a state of threat all of the time. And I mean, it was during that period.
And
it was kind of regular bombs.
Losing relatives
And my mum lost her brother during the Troubles. And most people who grew up there lost someone. That was everyday life. And the bombs and bullets and the not knowing what was coming next was part of life, which is an interesting thing for me, really, because the definition of anxiety is an intolerance of uncertainty. So I guess the one thing during that period that people had in abundance was they had a lot of uncertainty. They never knew what was going to happen next. So, it all fits together. You understand very well why people during that period were anxious.
You were caught up in a bomb blast at one point as a child.
Yeah, I mean, again, this was commonplace. My younger brother and I were in town one day shopping and an explosion went off and it was in a department store and we ended up, I mean, luckily we were fine, but we ended up covered head to toe in glass. And we were laughing about this a few weeks ago, actually.
Really?
We dusted off after it. When you think of how, abnormal it was, we just kind of were recovered literally from head to toe, shards of glass everywhere. And I can remember we dusted each other off and then we went, got chocolate and got the bus home.
Gosh.
So that's the sort of reality that was there.
Like that stoic kind of Ulster sense where everyone that was just normal day to day.
Well, that's the thing about it. I mean, everyone's talking about anxiety these days, but anxiety wasn't part of the conversation back then. I wouldn't even have known what that meant. And nobody was talking about being anxious. But it was just about survival and getting on with it. So it's interesting now that we've now got these very open, honest conversations about anxiety and a realisation actually how problematic it is for a lot of people.
Yeah. So that's one thing you're carrying, and then you have another challenge as well in your life.
I mean, there are a few, Oliver. How long have you got? I guess part of the thing as well is, I mean, I talk about this quite openly as well, as I mean, I grew up gay. Well, I wasn't gay as a kid. Obviously, I hadn't come out or anything. But there was a lot of bullying growing up. And I kind of think for anyone in that area of Irish Catholic Ireland where things were a lot stricter and things were different at that time. That was a challenge as well, growing up in that culture where right and wrong and good and bad were defined in a very, very clear way. And difference wasn't tolerated, very, very well back in those days. So I think that just kind of added another kind of flavour to the sense of threat and anxiety growing up.
What form did the bullying against you take?
I mean, it was interesting. It was almost a Billy Elliot type story because I was a little kid playing piano and a couple of my mates and stuff, they were doing dancing and art and stuff. It's really funny how kids find each other.
Yeah.
The kids find their tribe. So the kids who were a bit different were the kids who were being targeted. And I kind of guess because they're, kids are the best psychologists, aren't they? They spot difference. When someone's different and they spot a difference. So I think there were a group of us who got a pretty tough time during our kind of formative years.
It was pretty bad.
I mean, look, it was, I try, when I think back of, growing up, I try never to think about it as a a kind of victim story or a terrible thing, because I think a lot of people experience adversity in their life. Yeah, I mean, I had difficulties and I had challenges, but, you know, I hold the viewpoint that you can make decisions what you do with that. And you can decide either to be defined by it and victimized by it, or you can decide, actually, I'm going to let this kind of inform who I am and how do I grow, how do I develop, and actually how do I use my struggle to kind of do my work and actually hopefully make things a bit easier for people, you know, in day-to-day practice.
And there are kind of, it's funny now, I presume you look back as you do in the book, your mother, despite herself, was the first person to out you inadvertently, I presume.
Yeah, my mom's not around anymore, but I mean, yeah, that was quite an interesting period when kind of having to come out to Irish Catholic parents back in the 90s, you know, because it was just unheard of and stuff. And I remember when I came out to my mum, there was this kind of long silence, and then she said, I thought all the gays lived in New York.
They just magically popped up there.
So I thought, well, actually, no, they're a little closer to home than that. But, you know, back then, that was the sort of attitude. There wasn't awareness of it. But, you know, it's incredible, actually, how parents adjust and how they come to terms with stuff and how people get to understand. You know, I think that's, I often say, you know, around the whole coming out story, you know, there's an expectation sometimes that we expect people to come to terms with stuff very, very quickly, but often it takes us a long time ourselves to come to terms with it.
Yeah.
So it's often not realistic to expect those in our lives to understand it quickly. Sometimes it's a bit of patience about helping them, you know, understand things a bit better. And I learned that, you know, I guess, Oliver, it's one of the things about getting older, you become a bit wiser. And when you look back on things, you see them differently. And I can see that very differently now.
And what did your mum tell the neighbour?
Well, no, one of our neighbours asked at the time when my mum had mentioned me coming out, one of the neighbours asked, did I dress up in women's clothes?
Oh, God.
So she said that went off in a completely different direction. So, you know, and again, it's just that level of information and sort of some of the ignorance around sexuality at the time. And so my mum, I remember her telling me this story, and she says, well, not that I know of. She said, have you got anything else to tell me? And I said, no, we're good there. But actually, on the night I came out to my parents, there was this hilarious story. My mum went through this. I'd said to them, listen, I've got some news for you, something I want to talk to you about. And my mum went through this list of possibilities. So have you got someone pregnant? The big one in Northern Ireland at the time, are you going out with a Protestant? And so she went through all of this list. Are you taking drugs? Are you doing this and you're doing that? And the very last thing she then said was, are you gay? So it came as the last question, but it was interesting, the list of possibilities that went before it.
Right.
But actually, I think, you know, back in those days, if I had said I was going out with a Protestant, I think that would have been a bigger drama at the time, to be honest.
It's a harder so coming out.
So I think it was probably a bit of a relief. That's the world we lived in.
Yeah. You're typically Belfast stoic about all of your problems, but I presume all this stress did manifest itself in your adulthood when you move on and into a career and so on.
Well, here's the thing, you know, it's when I moved to London, actually, I suddenly realised, and this was part of the motivation for the book, Addicted to Anxiety. Mm. I realised that there was part of me primarily hardwired to keep an eye out for danger and for threat. And I, when I kind of moved away, I realised that my level of threat was higher than most other people I knew. That things that didn't bother them or things that weren't concerning them as much were bothering me. And I guess, you know, as therapists, we have to be in our own therapy. And I guess in my own therapy, that I did discover that there was part of me probably had more anxiety than I needed. And that's the key thing for most people. You know, if you're primarily hardwired for threat, or if you've grown up with anxiety, most people of adults never think of going back and updating the script, because very often the anxiety that existed when we were younger isn't required anymore. So very often it's about going back and kind of recognising that and updating the nervous system, actually, that there's no current threat, there's no current danger. You're not in that same situation anymore. So very often, you know, anxiety and trauma often very, you know, they often come hand in hand. And that very often includes, yeah, and it often includes childhood trauma. You know, so I've never met anyone who has had any degree of childhood trauma, whatever that is, who doesn't have some degree of anxiety. And if you don't deal with the anxiety and you don't go back and update, then, of course, anxiety is going to come with you. And, you know, and this is the thing that's really important about anxiety. I never at any point in this book talk about getting rid of anxiety. You never want to get rid of it. Yeah. You never want to push it away. Anxiety is a really helpful mechanism. You know, we need to have anxiety. It's a useful thing. The problem for most people is, and I think what we see in everyday life at the moment is that most people's anxiety is ramped up way higher than it needs to be.
Right.
And the problem with that is most people don't know what to do about it. And that there within is a challenge. And they also don't realise that they are a part of the maintenance of anxiety. And that's a conversation that we're not having enough. People like to have conversations about anxiety as something happening to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true to your point. But actually, every person I sit down with that I'm working with in therapy, when I speak to them about their anxiety, what I discover is that they're doing a lot of things that actually maintain their anxiety.
And even this is the key component, isn't it? You think we're hooked on it. Why would someone get addicted to something that's so negative and they know it's negative as anxiety is?
It's a brilliant question. So if you think of any addiction, so if you think of someone who's addicted to drunk or to drugs, to drink or to whatever, there's a double-edged sword. So at one level, they will get benefit from the addiction in terms of escapism, ease and pain, not feeling for a while. But every addict I've ever met will always talk about the darker side of the addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with anxiety comes with a huge promise. It promises to keep you safe, to protect you, even though it feels terribly uncomfortable. So when you're working with people who are anxious, they often describe hating the feeling of anxiety. They don't want to feel anxious. But then when you try to move them through the anxiety and move them beyond it, they resist it because they... Let me give you an example. This is probably the best way I can describe it.
Yeah.
I had a client a few weeks ago and I've been working with her now for a couple of months, and she came into therapy and she said, "I'm feeling brilliant. I'm feeling really, really good." And she said, "You know, for the first time in 4 years, I sat on the edge of my bed the other day when I woke up and I didn't have those knots in my stomach."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, that's brilliant. God, it's really great to see you kind of breaking through." And then she went quiet. And then she said, "I'm a bit worried." And I said, "What are you worried about?" She said, "I'm worried what happens without the anxiety."
Oh, Christ. Okay.
So what happens if things go wrong? What happens if I miss something? And I think, even though that might sound a bit extreme, what happens, and this is the addictive component of it, I think people become addicted to anxious thoughts and, you know, the what if, the catastrophizing, the worrying, the predicting. People engage with those thoughts as if they're a fact, and they get very, very tied up in the spiral.
So you kind of
thinking,
it could be a small thing and you turn it into a huge thing because you're always just looking for something to be anxious about.
Yeah. And you over-engage with the thought. And of course, the more you do that, the anxious brain will feed off that and then produce more and more content. So that's kind of just one of the components where people, they get attached and they get hooked to habits of thinking where they're almost kind of habitually looking for the problem or imagining the worst is going to happen. Mm. And the same thing happens with the emotions as well. As most people who describe anxiety will also talk about not liking the feeling, you know, the fear, the dread, the uncertainty that comes with it. But most people try to push the feeling down. They don't want to feel it. But the problem with that is, you know, emotions have a beginning, middle and end. They need they need to flow through.
Mm-hmm.
And if people are pushing the emotion down or trying to get rid of it or repress it in any way, the problem is it accumulates, which is why people often describe feeling uptight, feeling like they're overwhelmed, like they're not coping, because all of this emotion has been held back. So it's a really complicated process in the sense that people don't want it, but at the same time, they do a lot of stuff that means that they don't let it go.
There are interesting things you have, such as being hooked on anxiety because it's comforting in ways. It makes decisions for you. Explain that for us.
Well, I mean, it's like, say, for example, you had something big on today, Oliver, that you were nervous about. Say you had a big presentation or a gig to do and you felt nervous about it. Your anxious brain might jump in and say, "Oliver, don't do it.
Yes,
it's too risky. You might get rejected. You might get criticised. It would be easier not to do it." So your anxious brain might convince you not to do it because that would be a safer option. And if you listen to that, then you might pull out of the gig and not go and do it. Now, the problem is people who do that, then shorter term, they feel better. But the problem is longer term, the anxiety gets maintained.
They start to wonder what would have happened if they just gone ahead. So they lose opportunities as well.
Well, they lose opportunities, but actually what they do is they reinforce the mechanism of anxiety, because if they have felt short term, okay, I got relief and I felt better by not going, You know, so I didn't go to that job interview. I didn't do that talk. I didn't go to that social event. Whatever the context might be, people get short-term relief out of the avoidance.
Yeah.
But the problem is longer term, that then feeds the mechanism. So anxiety doesn't back off. It just keeps coming back. So inadvertently, one of the kind of challenging things about anxiety, and for anyone listening today, this is going to feel completely counterintuitive, but everything that you're doing to manage your anxiety, whether that's kind of avoidance, whether it's pushing it away, mm-hmm. whether it's doing things to try and soothe it and get rid of it, these are all of the things that will feel right and they will feel intuitively right. But the problem is they're counterintuitive because most behaviours around anxiety are actually going to keep it going longer. So you're actually bringing people in a really different direction to try and get them unattached from these patterns, and then they start finding their breakthroughs. And the good news in all of it is that, you know, anxiety is really treatable. And my experience, you know, if people have a negative relationship with their anxiety and they don't like it and they see it as a toxic, awful thing in their life, well, then that's what it becomes. So when I'm treating someone, my first line of kind of attack really is to help people build a more positive relationship with their anxiety so that it doesn't become the enemy.
Right.
That
now,
they start to understand.
Before
you
come to your tips, I want to kind of put to you, how will you know if your anxiety is kind of the part and parcel part of your life, the normal anxiety, versus if you have the bad anxiety that you need treated?
Yeah, it's a good point. So, you know, look, functional worry is a part of our everyday life, and functional thoughts are part of our everyday life. So, you know, if someone today is, they've got a hospital appointment they're going to, they may be worried about going to that hospital appointment. We wouldn't say that's an abnormal worry. Or, you know, if one of their kids was sick or whatever the context might be, that's functional, normal worry. When we start to think about anxious worries that become more problematic, that's when, you know, worry tends to become very ramped up. It becomes almost at the point of focus. And that can play out in many ways. It can be multiple worries. It can be worry about a specific thing like health or socializing, or it could fall into the parameters of something like OCD. But my bottom line is, if anxiety is starting to get in the way of your life, if it's starting to impact how you relate to people, if it's starting to impact in your job, if it's starting to impact in your social life, and the bad days are beginning to outnumber the good days, then that's a really good time to either pick up a book like this or talk to someone or get help, because that means actually anxiety is in the driving seat of your life. You're not in the driving seat anymore.
Right.
That's when you need to start looking at it.
And this is where you come to the practical techniques in the book.
Yeah. And you look, here's the thing, Oliver, I think this is a really important point. I could talk to you about hundreds of techniques today.
Right.
And in my experience, if people hold a negative belief about their anxious self, you know, and I often refer to it in the book as the anxious self, it's that part of you that's scared. If you hold a negative relationship with that part of you, then what you end up doing is you end up repressing that part of self, and you end up abandoning, you know, you abandon that self in some way. So no technique in the world is going to have a lasting difference if you keep rejecting that part of yourself. So one of the biggest breakthroughs is when people say, okay, this is a part of me. It's a normal part of me. It's a part of me that I'm not going to reject. I'm going to try and understand it more. I'm going to try and work with it. And I'm going to try and learn to negotiate with it. I think when people learn that skill, they're halfway there. Then all of the other techniques then become much more effective. So, you know, for anyone listening who has an awful relationship with their anxiety, I promise you wholeheartedly, just this one tweak where you start to look at it differently and think, okay, well, this is just a helpful part of me that means well. Mm-hmm. It tries to protect me, but sometimes it's just working way, way too hard. And my job is to re-educate it and start to work with it in a different way. I think above everything, that is my number one tip.
Right.
That shift for most people can be monumental. And I've seen people in treatment for years, and they've done everything. They've meditated, they've done mindfulness, they're in cold water, they've climbed mountains, they've done everything. But when you speak to them about how they feel about their anxiety, they immediately tear themselves apart and they tear the anxiety apart. And there, for me, is something really, really important. You know, create a new relationship with it to start.
Very good. I'm going to put some questions to you, Owen O'Kane, because they're coming in on the text 51551. Someone says, I'm not sure if it's anxiety or depression, but most mornings I wake up feeling consumed by worry. Mind seems to search out every possible problem. When up and about, things are reasonably okay. I suppose when they're up first thing in the morning, they're consumed by worry.
That's a really common thing, Oliver. So in the morning time, our cortisol levels are higher. And that means we can worry more. There's always a lot of chemical stuff going on in the body. And what I'd say is, you know, people ask that question all the time. What's the difference between anxiety and depression? I kind of think a really straightforward way to answer that is to think about speed. So people who are anxious often have a lot of hyperactivity going on in their body, a lot of activity going on in their mind. They often feel quite wired. They often feel quite uptight a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And from that question and that description, if there's an overload of worry and a lot of overthinking, then that's probably more likely going into the parameters of anxiety.
Yeah.
Now, what you can get is you can get secondary depression. I sometimes see people who are so exhausted with worry that sometimes there's part of the brain called the dorsal brain, and sometimes it will kick in and almost, you know, force the person to go into a state of collapse just to allow the brain time to rest. And that can be more a secondary depression that can come with it. The other side of the coin is if someone is depressed, it's normally a different feeling. It's normally a lot more exhaustion, a lot more demotivation, a sense of gloom. The speed, the activity of thoughts can be much more sluggish and slow, so it has a different flavour to it.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's another person said, I've experienced anxiety since my teens. When I had my first panic attack at uni, I noticed significant increase in anxiety during the perimenopause. I wish there was more awareness of this huge hormonal impact on so many women. Trying to cope with work, kids and life when anxiety makes it hard to leave the house is tough.
It's a really massive issue. In fact, I was speaking to Davina McCall last week on her podcast. Yeah. Davina's done a lot of work around menopause and stuff, and that was one of the conversations we were having around menopause. Now, here's a really interesting thing. This happens for women, but I also think we need to have more conversations about men and the hormonal changes that come later in life. I know and I see a lot of men who have hormonal changes, and of course we don't have this conversation because it's just seen as a bit woke. But men have hormonal changes as well, and it's often misdiagnosed as depression, you know, because they get there's a lack of testosterone and there are changes in hormones. So it's not just a female conversation. I think there's a conversation with men here as well. But it does massive, massive contributory factor to anxiety. And you know, that's the thing. Anxiety is never a single component. It's not just always about hormones. It can be about background. It can be about trauma. It can be about the external stressors. And in my experience, you know, anxiety often is a family affair. Mm-hmm. You know, yes. if a child is anxious, then often the parents are anxious because they're worried about the child.
Someone's actually said anxiety has ruined my entire life. Was born in rural Mayo in 1950, inherited it from their mother, they believe.
Yeah, I mean, this is not judgments on parents in any way, shape or form. I do think it's a family affair. And I was having a conversation last week, you know, parents, you know, we have a lot of anxious children at the moment. And, you know, it comes up in every talk, every conversation I do about anxious children. And I think very often parents mean well. They want to support the child and they want to reassure it as much as possible. And if the child says they don't want to do something, then they kind of say, OK, well, you don't have to do it. And very often, you know, when you're supporting a child with anxiety, what you're trying to do is you're trying to help the child self-nurture and self-soothe and gain confidence that they can cope, because over-reassuring the child can make them more anxious, even though that's going to feel counterintuitive for the parent.
Wow.
And also for the child who the parent said, okay, you don't need to go, you don't need to do it. Sometimes a more powerful thing would be, okay, let's see if we can do it. I'm going to come with you. Let's think about how good you'll feel afterwards. Now, obviously, you never want to overwhelm the child. But in psychology, we talk about safety behaviours. And children will often come up with a lot of safety behaviours that actually, the goal is to try and not feel anxious. But in some ways, what you're trying to teach the child is that you can feel anxious and you can cope with it and you will manage it. So I think this is one of the things I get most passionate about is a lot of stuff that you see online talks about getting rid of anxiety, when actually it's never ever about getting rid of anxiety. It's about recognizing it and, really more importantly, learning how to navigate it and learning how to work with it in your life. That for me is way more powerful.
And there are tips in here. Of course, if you have anxiety, you're probably thinking, well, a self-help book is not going to help me because I'm too anxious to sit down and follow through some of the breathing exercises and the tapping once you've calmed your mind.
I would disagree. Because I think, I mean, I don't want to sound self-congratulatory here with this book, but when I wrote in Addicted to Anxiety, my premise when I sat down to write this book was that it was a book that I wish someone had given me in my 20s. when I didn't understand what was happening for me. So what I've done in this book is I've broken it down really carefully so that someone doesn't get overwhelmed. And I break it down bit by bit, you know, understanding what's happening for you, why you've got hooked, your role in it. And, you know, and there's never a judgment or a shaming in that in any way, shape or form. And then what I do is I break it all down. I break down the thoughts and the mind. I break down the emotions, what's happening in the body. Now, here's a point, Oliver, I should have mentioned earlier. The chemicals that we secrete in the body when we're anxious are the same chemicals that we secrete when we're excited.
Okay, can't win.
So it's a really interesting thing is that, you know, if you think about it, if you're really excited, you've got no problem with those feelings that go on in your body because you're associating it with excitement.
Yeah.
When we're fearful and when we're anxious, we've got the exact same mechanism going on in the body. Mm-hmm. But actually, the only difference is our interpretation and our over-engagement with the mind about what might be happening. So, you know, the power in all of this here is, you know, for anyone listening today who might be feeling anxious or overwhelmed or feeling that there isn't hope, you know, I promise you wholeheartedly, and I say this as a human being who's lived through anxiety, there is a way through. There are so, so many things that you can do that will help. And, you know, because it feels awful today or you feel overwhelmed or it feels like anxiety is in charge, that isn't the case. The more you can learn to step back and get to understand this more, and learn to work with your anxiety as a really good force in your life that you just need to learn to work with in a very different way. Breakthroughs really do begin to happen. I see them every day in my career, which is why I do this work. So for anyone who is feeling a bit hopeless, I promise you wholeheartedly, you know, there is something in this book for everyone. But if you are feeling up against it or you feel like you're not coping, this is a temporary state. Things can improve. They do improve. So I'd really encourage people to pick this up and read it.
Well, staff and players at Manchester United might have a bit of everyday anxiety about a new move at the club that will effectively close their canteen. Today with Claire Byrne, found out why.
The staff canteen at Manchester United is to close as part of the latest round of cost cutting at the troubled club. The CEO, Omar Barada, told staff, "We've lost money for the past five consecutive years. This cannot continue." Let's get more on this now. I'm joined by the reporter who broke the story, Manchester football correspondent for The Guardian and The Observer, Jamie Jackson. Hello, Jamie.
Hello.
Nice to have you with us. Now, we knew that there had been cuts a couple of months ago at Manchester United. Then we were warned last week there was more to come. But this is real. It feels like bottom of the barrel stuff when you say to your staff, you can only have soup.
Basically, the canteen, as I understand, it's going to close at the end of this week. Currently, you know, all staff members, there's about 800, that sort of number at Old Trafford, could go in there with their pass, get a, you know, free hot meal, tea and coffee, etc. They do charge for some soft drinks, but essentially it's all free. And yeah, that's going to go to fruit in bowls, I'm told, fruit bowls. That's at the stadium. And then at the training ground, as you mentioned there, apart from the players, yeah, it's soup and some bread, mm-hmm. as I understand it. That's what's going to happen. So as you say, it's tough times.
Yeah, I don't know if you'd agree, but listening to the management and the statement from the CEO yesterday and from Ratcliffe, the owner, there's a sense of the beatings will continue until morale improves at Manchester United.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know a lot of people there, obviously, and morale is, you know, close to zero kind of thing. It's not great. I mean, you know, on the one hand, what we're looking at, listen, if we zoom out, this is about Malcolm Glazer taking over the club in 2005, 20 years later, what all the sort of people thought at the time, you know, the debt that he loaded on the club for 500 million-ish at the time, it's now the best, well, it's over a billion, really. And, you know, the club is on its knees basically through years and years of decline. Once Ferguson left in 2013, it really kicked in because you didn't have this genius manager basically being able to sort of corral the players, and they've wasted a heck of a lot in the transfer market. And it's just, you know, Ratcliffe's come in and I think he's got the right idea, but I think he's not doing it particularly in a great way. But he really doesn't care. He's a billionaire and he sees this as the way forward.
Mm-hmm. Like some of the staff impacted by the layoffs, they've been at the club for 10, 20, 30 years. I mean,
you
probably know the people that I'm talking about. And we hear that when they're gone, that really has a sort of an outsized impact on everybody around them.
It's very sad. I mean, it's like a family. You go into the club, you see them, really nice people. It makes the club, it's Manchester United, it's massive, but it actually makes it like a local club, you know, because they're so nice. And so it is a shame. I mean, you know, this is misery for people and their families. So on the one hand, you know, Ratcliffe thinks this is the right thing to do. But on the other hand, you just wonder whether you know, all the waste on players and wages, maybe that's maybe, which he will be trying to address, but that's really where the cost is coming. You know, for example, closing the canteen will save £1 million a year. That's a big saving, don't get me wrong. But Marcus Rashford, it's not his fault. He earns that in just under 3 weeks.
Sorry. Yeah, it's ridiculous. You know, it really is ridiculous. But if you're operating at that level, you can't reduce the players' salaries because they'll just all leave, right?
Yeah, this is the chicken egg thing. I mean, Berada, as I understand it, said in the meeting yesterday that, you know, he pointed to other clubs who have got leaner off-field operation and they've got on-field success. So that's the model they're going to go to. Go to a more incentive-based pay thing, yeah, for players. But you're kind of right what you say there. I mean, you know, what we're talking about here is part of the wider mess that is this club. I mean, chaos is a bit strong to describe Manchester United, but it's veering towards that. There's a sort of, but at the same time, I'm told very strongly that within 2 years from now, after this, United will be able to compete in the transfer market at elite level with elite clubs, both in terms of, you know, buying players and paying them the way sort of wages we're discussing. So let's wait and see.
Okay. Well, I mean, the management does claim that there are much leaner clubs out there achieving greater success. Is that true?
I mean, if you look at Manchester City across town here, yeah, I mean, you would say that, you know, they are definitely in profit with regard to sales. You know, Manchester United, the last player Manchester United made a profit on is Daniel James. Dan James, he went to Leeds, and I think the profit was about 10 million. They lose money. Example, they bought Paul Pogba, then a British record, 89.5 million. He left on a free. You know, that's just one example. So I think they can definitely sort their house out with regards to this. I think it is correct that, yes.
But, I mean, is it the case that Manchester United's support staff, backroom staff, expanded too much during the glory years? You mentioned, you know, Alex Ferguson there. His success was able to sort of cover a multitude of what was going on in terms of spending. Is that what we're saying?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, as I said earlier, if you look at the last squad, for example, that Ferguson won the title with, their last title, 2012-13, it's not an amazing squad. Obviously, you know, Robin van Persie, Rooney, brilliant players, but it kind of, you know, it wouldn't stand up now. But the genius of Ferguson, as you basically said then, was able to marshal them or corral them into another title winner because of his sort of aura. That's kind of gone, and it's kind of fallen apart since. I mean, I've sort of seen six or seven number ones follow him, you know, Solskjaer, Mourinho, Van Gaal, big names, right? David Moyes, now Amorim, and they all walk into the club thinking they can sort it out, but the place is difficult to manage at the best of times. Mm-hmm. It's Manchester United, but, you know, when it's like this, without really strong leadership, which again, I go back to Ratcliffe, this is what he thinks he can bring to it. I'm not so sure. The jury's out. But yes, the staff have become bloated, and wages particularly on players that are no good. Listen, if you're a top player, Harry Kane, you know, whoever, you're worth the money. If not, you know, do not be paying Anthony, whatever it is, 150 a week and pay £80 million for him. It's not his fault it costs that much. But, you know, it's another example of a waste.
On and off over the last few days, there's been this thing in the sky, but I could hardly remember its name until I was told it's the sun. Boy, is it welcome. Although it does shine a light into some nooks and crannies in the home, which we might have neglected in the dull days of winter. Claire Byrne, guilty as charged.
When the sunlight came over the weekend into our homes, beautiful beams of sunlight. Brenda Power's writing about this in the Mail today. I'm delighted she said it. Cobwebs, dust. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't there the day before.
It looks like Halloween decorations that we didn't take down.
But you noticed that in your greenhouse, Catherine, did you?
Yeah, my greenhouse. And do you know what as well? With all of the storm and winds that we've had, the glass is extra dirty. It's almost like there's this film of grey on it. So with my actual house windows and the greenhouse, I find the easiest way to clean it is get yourself a bucket of warm water, good old fairy washing up liquid, get a sweeping brush, dunk it in, scrub your window, and then I have an extendable squeegee because I'm only 4'11", and use a squeegee to wipe it down. You don't need any fancy gadgets to clean your windows. I find that's the easiest way to do it. And with your greenhouse or your polytunnel, I don't use power washing or anything like that in case it'll damage the glass because it's thinner. Mm-hmm. So I find doing that, scrubbing it with a brush, fairy washing up liquid, and then just giving it a squeegee down. And also, if you have any green algae I love the product Algon.
It's very good. Yeah.
You can get a lot of those algae killer stuff in the hardware shops, but a lot of them are full of chemicals and we
don't want that.
Your plants and whatever. But I swear by that Algon stuff because I have a wooden greenhouse and I have wooden raised beds as well. And you just mix it with water, spray it on, and after a couple of weeks, the green just disappears. Mm-hmm.
Mm. And we have to leave the spiders alone as well, don't we?
Yeah, but I think just balance. You can take the cobwebs away and they can just rebuild.
Mm-hmm. Well, you want the spiders, don't you?
Do. I want, you know, there is a kind of, I always say, don't be too clean, you know, whatever about the house, but not outside in the glass house and stuff like that. You can afford to have the cobwebs and you can afford to have, things that are going after other things. So if you have aphids in the glass house, you want to invite the slugs and the birds in.
That's something I've noticed actually in the greenhouse is there's a couple of geraniums that have survived the winter. Little aphids on the leaves.
Yeah.
So keeping the spiders in to do their job.
So the first thing we're going to do then is the spring clean. That's the starting point, is it?
Yeah. And things like, yeah, and if you are going to be sowing seeds coming into March, it's not a fun job, but cleaning out your seed trays.
I have to, yeah. They have to be sterile enough. I mean, when you think about it, you're growing seed, they need to germinate in really good compost that doesn't have any competition. Otherwise, you're not going to get, it's called the strike rate in terms of the germination of seeds. So everything has to be sterile in terms of that sort of thing. But generally, you know, I wouldn't go too mad.
It can be very tempting to pick up a dirty old plastic pot and throw compost in, but do clean them.
And especially when you're redoing pots. If you're redoing pots for, say, I've brought in a collection of maybe primroses that are happening now in the garden, and then I'm looking ahead to the summer. Now I know, you know, we mightn't think we're going to get one, but we are. So I'm looking at dahlias. Dahlias, tubers like that. So I'm looking ahead to them. So I want to be potting them up now so they'll start off a little bit earlier so they can get them in the ground then maybe in May and June. So I'm looking ahead. But if I put them into really dirty old pots, it's just the wrong thing to do. So just take out the old soil, put in some new compost, bit of grit, because you don't want them to get too wet because they'll just perish. So just, you know, be mindful of the fact that it's just good plant husbandry, really, you know.
Yeah, everywhere is so wet, though, isn't it? I mean, that's the problem dreadful. With this.
It's dreadful. So I'm thinking lots of window boxes and pots, really.
Window boxes. And also, if you want to bring some pots inside as well. So don't worry if you have forgotten to plant spring bulbs back in autumn. If you're in the garden centre, you'll see loads of little, they're like 2-3 euro. You can get mini daffodils, snowdrops, muscari, hyacinths. They're lovely in a terracotta pot, bit of soil, plant them up together. Dress them with some sphagnum moss on top and put them on your windowsill or have them in the kitchen on your table. Because if you get cut flowers, they might last a week. But if you put them bulbs in a pot inside, you might get 2-3 weeks out of them. So a nice little display over Easter
Yes, and we all need that, you know, at this time of year. We're getting the bit of sun. Yeah. What should indoor geraniums be doing now? Are they green without flowers and how can you encourage them along?
Well, mine's looking dead, so.
They like to overwinter without any water. So if you have them in pots in the glass house or in at home, they don't, you know, you can cut them back, any kind of browny bits you can cut them back, and then that encourages, and give them a little drop of water, that encourages now them to grow from the base. So last year's geraniums, I have loads of them and they'll all be potted up. Generally I just throw them onto the compost heap. I know that's desperate, just throw them onto the compost heap and then come out at this time of the year, bring them in and put them into pots and get them going again. And they'll be double size, they'll be much bigger than the ones you're going to buy in the garden centre.
Well, I have one now and it's just all green leaves.
Yeah,
it's
perfect.
In the pots and I didn't touch it now. Yeah. It's in the pots and
you're such a good gardener, Claire. That's
resting.
What it is.
It's just resting.
My strategy of not touching the plant may have worked. But like it's big. There's lots of green on it. Should I have cut it back now? Is it probably too late to
do
that?
You can, but what you can do if you want more is just take a few cuttings. You know, so say you particularly like the colour. I don't know if it was red or pink or whatever, but if you liked the colour, you can take a few cuttings of them. Just put them into a mix of one part compost to one part perlite or horticultural sand, and just they'll grow little root systems and they're new plants for you. So you're doing two things: you're cutting it back, getting it ready for the summer, and you're taking loads of cuttings
to give
to your friends.
I can't just leave it there now. No. I have to do something with it. Now I have loads of questions here coming in. Is it too late now to prune a metre tall rosemary plant? A metre tall rosemary plant?
No,
that sounds very impressive.
Not at all. That's probably Mrs. Jessop's upright. So there's a rosemary.
Don't know which Mrs.
Mrs. Jessop's upright. So yeah, just to give it its full title, you have rosemary that grows along the ground, so it won't get that tall. And then you have Mrs. Jessop's Upright, which is a tall rosemary that you'd probably use as a kind of a hedging sort mm-hmm. of thing. So absolutely you can cut it back.
You can do that now. Okay.
Go for the yeah. roast chicken yeah. dinner.
That's it.
That's it. My Magnolia stellata is budding on one side only. The other side's very dry and sad looking with no hint of growth. Have you any suggestions?
The roots have dried out on that side. I mean, I know we're saying that we're waterlogged with this, that and the other. You could find that your Magnolia stellata is also maybe up against a hedge or a wall. So that side is obviously going to dry out much more. So it could be just so. The best thing to do with something like that is to mulch it heavily. You know, give it a good feed, mulch it heavily so that the water kind of stays in the ground. It doesn't kind of leach away. And by doing that kind of on year on year, you're kind of cultivating the ground and you're making it more accessible for the root system at the back of that
right.
tree.
Eileen would like to know, is it a good time to start feeding your house plants and the plants in the garden? Should you be doing that now?
Yeah, I always get Osmocote. So it's a slow release fertilizer. So it's one type fits all. So it's a little box and they're like little it's like little balls of food. Once it's over 5 degrees, it releases the nutrients once it's watered into the ground.
And how often should you put that down? Like once a month?
So it says every 6 months. That's the great thing about reading the packets, you see. It says every 6 months on the back of it or every 3 months. See. So
don't overdo it, you see.
Yeah, night cup full. Perfect for a pot. Or then if you have flowers out on the border, just scatter it through the border. So when it's raining and it's over 5 degrees, it'll start feeding those plants. Mm-hmm. And, it's perfect.
Great. Now, Catherine, your DIY jobs, I know you always have a plan of something, that
sometimes.
Project that you're going to do. Have you got something this year that you're looking at achieving?
I'm redoing my stairs at the minute. So I'm doing because I've done some renovation stuff upstairs and that's kind of complete. So I'm going to redo the stairs and I am tempted to take down a wall.
Oh,
and I started tile. Yeah, it's not. I have to get some help with it. And I started, I dipped my toe into tiling before Christmas.
Yeah.
My niece and nephew's granny let me tile the downstairs bathroom. Okay. So that was very kind of her.
And did it work?
But I just took some time to practice with my cuts. I got myself an electric tile cutter.
Oh, very posh.
So I just ease myself into it before going all in. But yeah, planning ahead is definitely the thing, especially when it comes to planning your budget as well.
And what about the stairs now? What are you going to do with your poor stairs?
So I'm going to do a bit of paneling on it, a feature wall at the top, add some extra storage. And then I did actually do a DIY stair runner a couple of years ago, but my cat destroyed it. They treated it as a giant scratching post. So I think I'm going to invest in something a bit stronger when it comes to the stairs.
And you were exploring beekeeping as well the last time we were chatting. How's that
time,
going?
I was on last year, your listeners might remember, chatting about becoming a beekeeper.
Yeah.
So this was my first winter. And something I learned this winter, and your listeners, because once you see this, you can't unsee it.
So I hope they've had their breakfast.
So I hope you've had your breakfast. Yeah. If you have your clothes on the washing line today, especially if it's a white sheet, and if you see any little tiny dots that look like pollen, this actually is probably, this time of year, bee poop. So I learned that bees don't leave the hive over winter because it's too cold. So they won't come out of the hive if it's like below 10 degrees-ish. And this time of year, also they don't poop in the hive. So they have to hold it in. So they haven't left the hive December, January.
So they've been holding their poop
been
for
holding
the whole
it
winter.
In, and now they do a cleansing flight is what it's called. That's the
spa.
The term. So you'll see them coming out of the hive and they just fly around, do their business, and you'll notice it on leaves. And this is honeybees as well, but obviously other bees will do it. But if you do notice specks on your windscreen or your washing line, and you're like, what is that? It's probably bee poop this
the
time.
The bee has had a colonic.
Yes.
And it's out.
Does it come off?
Leaving it on the
yeah,
sheet.
Yeah, it'll come off. And do you know what? I didn't notice it. I obviously saw some outside of the hive. And then once I seen it, I was like, oh, actually.
That's what it is.
That's what that is.
Mm. Every day is a school day.
Every day is a school day. So a cleansing flight. So next time you need the loo, just say, I'm off on a cleansing flight.
And what's happening with your own bees? Is it working?
So my two bees. So I have one hive and then I have the swarm that I caught. and they're in a nuke, which is a small hive. So they'll go into a big hive this year. So please God, I'll have two strong queens and two strong hives. Last year, I didn't get any honey off mine. I brought in some honey, actually. So this is from the apiary where I help out and I learn.
You're learning.
Yeah. And then my other two bees, hopefully I'll get some honey this year.
So you'll be back with the honey now in
hopefully,
a couple of months'
please
time.
God, I'll have some
look
cook and some honey.
That was gardener Mary Staunton and DIY expert Catherine Carton on Today with Claire Byrne, teaching us all about, even though you didn't ask for it, bee poop. Lastly, 1,000 musicians have come together to record a silent album. It's in protest at proposed changes to copyright law around artificial intelligence in the UK. Entertainment journalist Caroline Frost joined Rachel English from there on the News at One.
The new legislation, which is going to be finished in its consultation today, will allow AI technology companies to effectively put their big spoon into the soup of all of existing music and to use that existing material, voices, tunes, notes, whatever you consider music to be, and to use it to train their software. Now, we know that this is the march of technology. We've seen it with acting. We've seen it with actors' voices. We've seen it with Michael Parkinson being created posthumously for a podcast. However, the musicians, particularly in this country, have come out fighting.
So tell us then about this silent album campaign. Are they expecting people to download it?
Yes, I think it's more of a gesture than anything. I mean, it is the deafening sound of silence. It is an album comprised of 1,000 musicians. I mean, we don't know how many people are involved in creating silence. It's available on Spotify. It's called Is This What We Want? And the idea is that people will buy it as a gesture. The money raised is going to a good cause. It's going to the charity Help Musicians, which helps musicians far and away in need and of all different economic hardship and other suffering. However, the point they're making is that there will be more of those people if this legislation is allowed to pass.
And this campaign, it has some pretty high profile support.
Yes, it has. So the roll call is pretty impressive. I mean, as I say, it's silent, so we will never know differently. But in theory, yeah.
Annie Lennox's silence sound like, and what does Kate Bush's silence sound like?
It's a higher clock. Kate Bush silence. Lots of people will pay good money just to hear a small breath from Kate Bush.
Heard it here first, or not, as the case may be. You can also listen back, though, in full to your favourite RTE Radio 1 programmes at rte.ie/radio or as podcasts from your preferred platform. Meantime, thanks for listening to Playback Daily. From me, Trevor Keegan. Bye for now.